what might be needed by way of that finance staff and on the sufficiency of the staff to the current tasks.
Okay. The organization has been growing. It looks like it may continue to grow. I do know that the accounting staff is probably at capacity in what they can perform. They do meet their demands, but it's I do see that they're working very hard. So I can't evaluate that on the spot, but I wouldn't be surprised if they might need to add a person in the accounting staff as the organization grows. There probably should be a little bit more of assistance between the accounting staff and the stations. That might require a little more time, where they work with, let's say you get a new business manager at a station, for example, on KPFK. That's going to require some time from the national accounting staff, et cetera. So I do believe they're stretched a little thin at the moment.
Patty, Mark, and then Lonnie.
I've just been asked from a member of the audience or a member of the foundation if they could if there could be any floor questions of the auditor or how they would go about that.
That was not part of the plan, but let's make sure that we get all the dialogue from the board first, and we'll see.
We have 20 minutes remaining. Mark. 18.
Thank you. I had a couple of questions as I was listening to what you were saying. One, I wanted to follow up on what Bob said about fraud or the detection of it. Now, my understanding is, I mean, let's say that I'm a station and I've said that I spent $10,000 and I bought a computer. And let's say you see that transaction and I reduce my cash by $10,000 and I increase the asset, or maybe there's some associated expense or whatever, and you ask to pull that, right, as one of your audit trail, one of your investigations. So you want to know where the receipt is. You want to see that, in fact, the check was cut to a vendor. You want to see that there's a receipt for the item, correct?
Right.
Now, if you were an investigator, because I could presumably create an invoice from, you know, my mother's, computer company and stick it in the file and presumably write it to her, and then she could go to the bank or whatever.
Right.
So that's what you mean by investigation. You don't go to the extent to ensure that it is indeed, Best Buy and that, you know, my mother. But you do ensure that the receipt exists for that transaction that you have pulled, correct?
Not only that the receipt exists, but that it's been properly approved and signed off on, both by someone with the authority to approve invoices outside of the accounting department as well as someone inside the accounting department.
Okay.
So you have to have that collusion going on to really fool the auditor.
Right. So it would have to be a pretty broad plot.
Right. It should not just be one person,
right.
Although
right.
It's right.
But we have
done,
those controls. We have those controls in place, right?
You do have controls.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And sorry, Mom, that I'm not trying to, you know.
Oh.
And the second thing I wanted to ask you was a general kind of feel, since you've been auditing for a while, and I know that you can't comment on, let's say, the release of financial data once it leaves the national office to, for example, members of the board or members of the community. But I'm just wondering, because a lot of times people feel that the flow of financial data within the foundation is not as free as they would like or whatever. Do you, in terms of your evaluation of the internal flow of financial data, do you find it to be, you know, secretive or difficult to obtain? And please answer this, notwithstanding your affection for Dan. but how do you feel about the flow of financial data within Pacifica at this point internally?
I don't think I would know if there's a problem internally with the flow of financial information. Obviously, the flow is very good with me. I get the information I need, or I couldn't do the audit. So if there's a problem internally, with someone not getting a report that they requested, I don't know that I would be aware of that. But let me do say that there's a very extensive accounting system with a lot of access to it from a lot of different members across the network. And I noticed that there's a lot of things on the website as well. Also, the Form 990, which is the federal form, is a public document. There's a great deal of financial information that is publicly posted. It may only be posted annually. But, and I know that Lonnie has posted a lot of historical information as well and comparisons. So relative to other organizations that I'm aware of, this organization certainly does a lot more disclosure than what is normal. But
thank you.
Internally, I wouldn't know.
LaVarne and then Lonnie.
Thank you. Just wanted to thank you again. Just wanted to go back over a point that you had made when you were, I believe, speaking with Mike, and or maybe it was with Mark, one of the M's over there. But you said in terms of looking at the finances on a monthly basis, you're saying that, that the process is a monthly review of actuals to budget. I just wanted you to like kind of go over that again so that people could understand that that is the process. And did you have an opinion in terms of looking not only at expenses and revenue but also at headcount? Or if you could just kind of talk about that a little more, I would appreciate it.
Excuse me, do you mean headcount in terms of payroll?
Well, in terms of the people who are on board, the employees of the foundation.
Okay, yes.
Right. yes, headcounts, independent specifics to statistical information to go along with financials is very useful. That's a very good point. That could also fall to the audit committee if you're concerned about any particular line item. The audit committee could have a subcommittee, an internal audit, that would go in and check headcounts and things like that for you. But basically what I mean is a line-by-line comparison of how did we do this month actually versus what the budget was, how did we do year-to-date versus what the budget is, and projecting that to the end of the fiscal year, what's our remaining budget. We may be over budget for the first 6 months, but we're anticipating going under budget for the next 6 months. So as you get involved in that process line by line and looking at a monthly number, a year-to-date number, and a remaining balance to the end of the year number, you get a very good understanding of what's going on, and you would be able to isolate problems as they occur and be able, so you can do something about them hopefully before it gets out, something gets out of hand.
Well, before we get to you, Lonnie, we've got two others, Steve and Dave and Patty.
I'm Steve Pierce from WRPI in Troy. Thanks for your report. I'm trying to understand more of what the information represents. Is it accurate to say it's basically that your role is to confirm the accuracy of the information that the board is supplying? Is that the purpose of the audit for the most part?
The purpose of the audit is a confirmation and issuing an opinion on information provided by the organization. We are commenting on the organization's report. This is not our report. This is Pacifica's report. Now we interact with the accounting staff. We recommend adjusting entries. They come up with adjusting entries. And our job is to be sure this is consistent with generally accepted accounting principles, that we've done our work, and that it presents fairly the financial results.
Yeah, because I know that board members are having to evaluate the information that comes officially through the national staff and then all a flood of information that comes from outside in the form of emails and anecdotal information. It's very difficult to evaluate because we don't have a basis to do it. But, for example, if listener revenue is down at a particular station, you don't have an evaluation about whether that's good or bad or systemic. Your report just confirms the accuracy of the information that the revenue is down.
Exactly. We might have a question. We might go back to management and state, is there a reason for this? What would you have a comment on this? Just so that we understand the information. We're looking for an error, really. If there's no error, then that's pretty much as far as we go with it. We just want to be sure the financial information is fairly correct.
And so to follow up on Marty's question about the presentation of the value of the frequencies, intangible assets, one of the intangibles strikes me is I don't know how to phrase it, listener trust or, well, for instance, the station that I'm from is a very small station. It's mostly volunteer and has a small budget. But we have, as an operating strategy, have chosen not to do underwriting because it helps us differentiate ourselves from commercial and public stations. And I know Pacifica does the same. But we've also chosen not to do on-air fundraising for similar reasons. To the extent that we can, we instead of raising money to pay for things, we try to get it donated, and we use volunteers. But we can because it's such a small station, such a small market. The reason I bring that up is, in conversations over the past day or so, routinely people suggest new initiatives and new programs, and then that there'll be a day of fundraising to cover it. It seems to me that there's a value to the amount of fundraising days that there are available to the station, the maximum amount that people will give. And when the stations are doing more and more on-air fundraising, it seems that from a common sense perspective, you're getting into dangerous territory. That's sort of the overfishing argument. And you might not realize that until years after the problem is irreversible. And I'm just wondering whether there's any way to ascertain those types of strategic problems from this kind of financial information.
Yeah, you're really referring to strategic management issues and planning processes and decision-making as to what's in the best interest of the organization. We pretty much come in after the fact, and we may comment. We have the luxury of time there, and we may comment on the results of those decisions financially, but we're not. That's not something that we would be making recommendations in the area.
Thanks for answering the questions. Mm-hmm.
Dave, Patty, Lonnie.
We recently got an income statement for the end of January. We've had since gotten February, and it indicated that it was an audited statement. And when I looked at that no, it was not audited. That there was a question about how certain lines became the way they are, but if they're not audited, they're not relevant now if it wasn't audited.
You say you have a February financial statement that says it was audited?
No, January.
Oh, January?
Ending January. The issue was in KPFK's total listener income for the month and their CPB grant, the year-to-date numbers match our records, but the listener for the monthly income, is a far cry from what MEMSIS reports came in during the month. And also, it shows a CPB blot of money in that month that I don't think came in that month. I think it's... I don't know how it's coming in, but the question was really, are you looking at the year-to-date numbers or do you look at the monthly numbers?
We have not done any audit work since the end of the financial year, September 30th, 04.
Okay, then the question's not relevant. We'll deal with it on finance.
All right.
Addie.
Yes, thank you very much. In looking at the statement of functional expenses here for FY 04, I see... as consulting fees, $14,000. In New York last year, I think ours was $125,000 at least. I'm concerned or curious as to, and then I think we were told that they dropped consulting fees into salaries and related. So I'm wondering, do you separate those out, or where would those consulting fees be? Is a subcontractor the same as a salaried person? How is that broken out, or is there any way to see that, or the contracts related? Do you check contracts related to subcontracting and consulting fees, or is that just all mixed in with salaries?
There is a salaries and related area, which I believe includes outside services that are sort of considered normal operating activities. And then below that section, under the other expenses, you have separate line items for consultants and professional fees, which are not a normal recurring activity. So because I believe the organization does have certain outside services that are ongoing regular activities, so it's been treated that way just to for budgeting purposes. One's budgeted different than the other, really.
Because that's like 208,000 across the network. If WBAI was around $125,000, you're saying that the rest of the network only consults for $70,000?
Which page are you looking at?
86.
Six, page six. Is that outside services? Is that what contract consulting is, or whatever we call that, unsalaried employees, or?
Okay, outside services for the whole organization was $263,000, and then consulting fees $14,540. Yeah, those are two different things. I'd have to see what's in that consulting number, but I would expect that to be a non-recurring item. That was a specific consultant for a specific purpose, whereas outside services are performing regular activities for the organization. Maintaining transmitters and stuff like that, I just heard a comment. Uh-huh. Lonnie, go ahead.
Well, or if the question is in relation to WBAI specifically, you want to look at the functional expenses in this audit under the WBAI. You know, there's page 22. And there you can see the true salaries versus consulting. And that's the true number. Now, the $135,000 that you referred to was an error. They, in fact, were putting salaries and consultants in one line item. That was corrected, so the $135,000 changed. And on audit, as you can see, if you look at salaries up top, you see that number there for WBAI, 1.1 or so. And then you want to look for consultant fees, and you look down below, you'll see that consulting is different than the consultants and salary and related. So that's how that's got broken out on audit. On audit, the corrections are made for misclassifications, stuff that went into consulting, didn't belong in consulting. These people were actually salaried and shouldn't have been consultant. A consultant, the test for a consultant, as Ross will identify, or an independent contractor, is that these independent contractor, 10 IRS tests for an independent contractor, and if they don't meet that test, what we did last year is have WBAI reclassify those folks to where they belonged, either salary, true independent contractor, or consultant, or vendor. And those are the areas that they got placed into. So to see what happened at WBAI on an audit, that's the page you would want to go look at.
Okay, William. So just for either Lonnie or Ross, we're not going to see our employees as consultants anymore, because that's what I keep seeing. So when our employees, they'll be salaried from now on. I mean, I see consultant payments for people that are full or three-quarters time staff. And I mean, I think that the IRS has something to say about that, right?
It will move through everybody's, yeah, we're going to move through everybody's books and make sure that across the stations, everybody's classified in the same way. Okay?
Hey, Bob.
A question from one of the members of the Finance Committee is, how is a consultant distinguished from a vendor? Like yourself, are you a vendor or a consultant? And how does one distinguish between the two things when you're dealing with things like professional services?
Okay, that's a pretty complicated issue. There's a 20-factor common law test applied to determining whether someone is paid as an independent contractor or as an employee. But one of the key factors is if you're dealing with a trained professional who brings their training to the job, then usually that's recognized as an outside independent relationship versus someone that you have to train and supervise and manage on the job. That's the key issue.
Outside relation.
One thing is an outside relationship, but you can have an outside relationship with either a consultant or a vendor, can you not?
You can have an outside relationship, you mean like outside service, independent contractor relationship?
Yeah. I mean, you could have been signed on, well, just in this instance, you're a vendor. Your company bills, and that would drop
right.
into the slot for vendors, correct? Legal
right.
services, obviously, not consultant fee. But somebody who comes in and, for example, looks at your architectural plan for ADA compliance issues, mm-hmm. Is that a consultant or is helping you with an elevator project like we have at the Pacifica building in Los Angeles? Is that a consultant or is it a vendor? Does it depend on the way that person bills you? How is it distinguished?
Well, we have a line item for legal and professional fees and a separate line item for the audit and accounting fees. Those are for those legal, outside legal and professional services. For technical consultants, if it's typically that would be under consultants, or some of them might be under repairs and maintenance and things like that. Outside services that's up in the salary and related area are sort of ongoing. These are independent contractors, or they should be, that are conducting regular activities, but they're defined as an independent contractor versus an employee because they really don't show up for work every day at 9 a.m. and ask to be assigned their tasks for the day. They come in as on a contractual basis, and they do a specific job, and they're bringing their own expertise and training and tools, et cetera, with them to do that job. That is one of the key factors in defining whether it's an independent contractor versus an employee. Like I said, it is a little bit of a gray area.
We're at time.
I hope I answered it as best I could. So.
We're at time.
Yeah. We're running out of time, you know. Bob,
I know we ran out of time.
But
a very short question.
Okay, Bob, Donna, LaVarne, very, very short.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to follow up on these definitions of consultants and outside services. There's been some confusion on I'm on the finance committee at WBAI, and the line item in our budget has been labeled consultants when it's actually, when we've probed it further, it turns out that it actually is a combination of genuine consultants and people who are in 1099s as outside services or vendors, contractors, and so on. So I would like to ask your recommendation in terms of nomenclature. What would be the clearest language and the most consistent language in the future for line items? Should they be broken out to separate? I notice in your report you do, as we've been discussing, you separate outside services from consultants. So how do you think budget should be organized so that that distinction is clear?
I think that's why it's being done the way it is now, is the salaries and related area is budgeted differently than the consulting line. The consulting line would be sort of on a non-recurring, specific, as-needed basis, whereas you're budgeting for the salaries and related area that you're going to need a certain level of vendor support or outside services. And that is why it's being broken out. I mean, technically, there's no difference with the IRS, whether it's an outside service or it's a consultant. That's the same thing in terms of tax law. But for budgeting purposes, you have two separate line items.
Donna?
Very short. On the listing of the expenses under audit and accounting fees, it has $80,942 for fiscal year 04. Was that what we paid you for the year? Or does that include other fees? I'm just wondering how much does it cost to employ you, Mr. Wisdom?
That's how much it costs for the audit and the tax work and the management comment letter, and that's pretty much it.
All of that was yours?
Right.
Oh, okay.
For that audit. It's coming in a little lower this year.
Oh, okay. Thank you. This is very brief. When you were talking about contracts in terms of IRS definition, do you also include in there in terms of length of service in terms of determining whether it's a contract or consultant or an employee, and is there a cutoff? And also, did you look for, like, signed contracts with these consultants and perhaps any competitive bids, or would you have an opinion about that in terms of how that should be handled?
Well, in our audit work, we do look at the documentation supporting a transaction, whether it's a signed contract or a paid invoice, and we do look at that. We do not look at something such as competitive bidding, for example, whether there should be or whether there was. We don't really look at that. What was the rest of your question?
Length of service in terms of determining whether the person is a consultant or an employee, and is there a suggested cutoff in terms of if a person is a consultant and how long that person should be on board before he or she becomes either a employee or no longer with the foundation?
Okay. There is no specific criteria. There's no what's called a bright line test determining that if you have this or you don't have that, then you're either an employee or you're an independent contractor. That's why I said this is a complicated issue. It's a 20-factor common law test. You can present the same facts to different people and get different results. Essentially, it does not go to length of service. Essentially, it goes to who controls the nature of the work. Is it an independent relationship, or is it really an employer-employee, the employer controlling the activities of the employee relationship?
Just a follow-up. So if this is just hypothetical, a person could be on board for like 5 years and still be defined as a consultant versus
yes.
an employee?
Yes, I've been an accountant here since 2002. I'm still an outside consultant.
Yeah, but I consider you more professional fees versus coming in-house.
Still the same issue. I happen to be licensed. That pretty much determines it, but it's still the same issue.
But in terms of you wouldn't be like in the facility on a weekly basis, 52 weeks a year though.
Hopefully not.
Very good. I'm not eating longer. Thank you.
I'm sorry. We're going to have to end this now. And I want to thank Mr. Wisdom and his firm for the excellent job they've done for us. We look forward to your management letter.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Folks, because we've got a time constraint, we're going to go immediately into the Finance Committee report. And we're not going to have time for it. We went over our time.
Point of order.
And let me also pass this around so those who want to public comment, sign up. Finance report, yes.
Point of order.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that whatever we do, that at 11:45 we break for public comment.
Oh, we got to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's 11:26.
Point of order.
Yes.
Is it possible for during the public comment for someone who has a question, such as this person, to ask a question to either the board or to Mr. Wisdom?
He won't be here.
Mr. Wisdom won't be here. We went over our time, and therefore we're not going to be able to take that question from him. If he wants to go over and personally ask him, that's fine. We've got to move the agenda. Will the Finance Committee please begin its report?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Finance Committee would lay out the report of the National Finance Committee, which I distributed to everybody this morning. You should have a copy sitting in front of you. If you would direct your attention into that document, and if you don't have one, I'll just pat Maria. Maybe you could.
Mr. Chair, given the extent of the National Finance Committee, which is probably the most active one, can we do that after the public comment?
Do what after?
We only have 15 minutes, so maybe we could go to one of those committees that's just getting together. The Finance Committee's got a lot to talk about, right?
Well, what we'll do is carry over after.
Carry over? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We've got to move the agenda. Go ahead.
Point of order.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, you know, I support the position there because it's if we break up the Finance Committee report, I don't think that would be very productive use of our time. And if we're going to public comment at 11:45 and we only have 15 minutes, I would suggest perhaps, from my opinion, that we just take a break now so that we can really be attentive to public comment and we won't have to get up and walk out to take nature breaks. So if we could just take a break now, I think that would be good, and then we can go to our committee reports after public comment.
Everybody like 5-minute nature break?
Why don't we,
alternative suggestion. The Governance Committee is presenting a single motion, which is relatively straightforward. We could do that in this period between.
We're never straightforward.
Okay, Mark needs to pee.
If we're going to take a break, can we just make this lunch and everyone needs to get their lunch?
No.
We just ate breakfast.
We got lunch already scheduled.
Just because.
The point of
yes, Donna.
I don't know what the point is, but the personnel committee, we have got to meet before we give this report because we just have to meet. You understand?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I do support.
Yes, speak up.
I do support having an alternative committee report presented during this time prior to public comment at 11:45. Either governance or archives, both of which are straightforward.
Well, which one is prepared to fill in this 15-minute space? All right, then we'll hear from governance now, and all those who want to participate in the public participation, please sign up, because as soon as that report is over, we'll go into that.
I unfortunately was not able to be on the entirety of the last governance committee call. We reported on the prior one at the telephonic PMB meeting. Coming out of this committee meeting, we have a single motion, and it refers to the creation of a Blue Ribbon Commission on affirmative action. The motion reads, and we discussed it for some time. There were some adjustments made to it, so it's the product of a great deal of discussion. Motion, whereas the Interim Pacifica National Board in its votes of September 21st, 2002 called for the immediate establishment of a National Commission on Affirmative Action and Equality, which would include both Pacifica activists and respected academic and community leaders to develop a detailed action plan on issues of inclusion throughout the network. Whereas the Interim Pacifica National Board in its votes of September 21, 2002 supported adoption by the next board of a bylaws amendment creating meaningful affirmative action for disenfranchised groups in the election of local and national boards. Therefore, be it resolved that the Pacifica National Board shall establish a Blue Ribbon Commission whose members shall be identified by the ad hoc National Committee of Inclusion, then recommended to the PMB with advice and input of the Executive Director in order to attain qualified legal opinions from civil rights attorneys and scholars on what forms affirmative action measures in Pacifica staffing, programming, and governance might take, that said commission be comprised of qualified attorneys, anti-racist activists, and legal and cultural leaders of communities of color. That's the motion. I want to clarify one thing that happened in the discussion, which was we wanted to clarify that the intent of this is that although that committee is recommending people, if the PNB had other candidates that it wanted to add to the roster, this motion does not contemplate restraining the PNB from adding them, and so the PNB would have the final say over the final composition of the committee. It's just that the initial recommendations are coming through the procedure outlined in the motion. So that's the motion of the governance committee.
And I second the motion.
Just as a point of order, I don't think motions from committees require seconds. But thanks anyway.
Point of information?
I'm not the chair.
This is the easy motion.
Who is chairing right now?
You say that you could add, the PNB could add, could they also remove a name from the list?
Yeah, this list is going to be recommended by that committee of people who are qualified for the position, but the PMB will approve the final composition, which means it could add people not on the list, or it could choose not to elect people who were on the list.
William?
I remember when this was sent that one of the reasons we sent it to the committee is that this motion doesn't deal this motion and the one that was referred to the committee doesn't deal with how many people are on this committee. And so we're still in the same place where this motion doesn't tell us if there's a limit to the number of people on this committee. It doesn't say how the ad hoc committee is going to go about identifying the members. And an ad hoc committee doesn't tell us how many people will be on it. And these types of committees like to 50 people like to be on these committees. And how is that going to help move forward this issue around affirmative action. If we've got 50 people that all think that they're blue ribbon status debating affirmative action, how's it moving us anywhere if we don't have any parameters for how this committee is, the composition of this committee can be created?
May I respond, Mr. Chair?
Well,
can I respond?
It's up to the chair.
Yeah, can I respond
yes.
to the question? And then Dave, I'm sure, can add. Those questions that William has are legitimate questions that I think really have to be worked out in some detail by the ad hoc committee when it sits down and looks at this. But I can tell you that the intent of those of us who wrote this originally and came up with the idea is not to create some gigantic commission. Quite the contrary, the goal here is to have some really clear answers in time for the bylaws convention, as well as for things that don't relate to bylaws, like affirmative action policies. And a lot of the lawyers involved in particular are going to be loath to commit their time with no compensation to a commission like this. So I don't think the problem is proliferation of numbers, but I think the ad hoc committee of inclusion needs to sit down and say what are the specific areas of expertise we need, and start identifying where do we find them, what organizations should we contact. So it's a little early to be specifying the numbers. And, of course, the board can weigh in on that. If they give a list of 8 and they say that's too small or too big, then the board could change that. But I think we have to let them do their work.
Yes, Patty.
This motion, as read, removed the amended that was passed at the board meeting in Los Angeles, further resolved that all legal opinions obtained by this committee shall be presented in full and in writing as part of the committee's report. And I'm concerned why that would ever be removed and to allow an illegal opinion not in writing to direct our affirmative action, which we already have gone through a couple of times, that we could not really get an opinion on the affirmative action and what was legal or not, and why we would remove I believe a very important sentence in this motion. I'd like that put back in. And also, it's true, committees have to be stated how many people and their time allotted, how long they're going to be functioning, and what their function is. I believe that's just a requirement to form a committee. So I would, how I do that, how that gets put back in, this legal opinion shall be presented in full and in writing, I think is a prudent and important thing that we have to have in these. We can't just have people from making decisions.
Dave, Mark.
Okay, I'll make that motion that it be put back in.
Is there a second to it?
Second.
We didn't have the minutes from the meeting, so I was not aware of this.
No,
amendment.
I'm sorry, you're incorrect. We did have them. I read that sentence that Patty had moved as an amendment, and we had a thorough discussion of this, actually, and we voted to delete that sentence from this motion. And I can explain very simply the
That's
rationale
right.
for it. This comes out of the experience of the last time when affirmative action was under debate in the adoption of these bylaws, and there was a real difficulty in getting lawyers to commit their time and energy. When you write a legal memo, perhaps one of the attorneys on the board should address this question. When you write a legal memo, you're committing
Excuse
yourself.
Excuse me, point of order. Was Bob called on? Was this?
Yes, he was.
You're committing yourself to, very specific legal conclusions based on very specific set of footnotes and citations and so on. And actually, maybe I should defer to one of the attorneys who might want to address this. The question is, when people are not paid for their services, it's unfair and unrealistic to expect them to write a full, official kind of legal memo, as opposed to having conference calls and email back and forth where there's kind of a collective wisdom as to what, and there probably will be 2 or 3 opinions, different opinions, about what will likely pass muster in the courts or not. But these are not kind of clear-cut areas. They're areas of interpretation.
Mark, and then
Yeah, I wanted to address this report in a little bit, but also all the reports in terms of, I mean, my understanding is that when we take a matter such as this, which I think is a little bit more complex than is suggested here, and we send it off to a committee, ideally what that the committee does is it explores all the, you know, the ramifications and the pros and cons of this pre-issue, then comes back to the board informing us of what their investigation has yielded so that we can therefore make an informed decision. Here we're basically taking, it's in a motion form. I don't know who the members of the committee are. I don't know what the vote was. I don't know anything about what was behind. I'm just given a motion. And I really I'd like to know more about how this issue was vetted, why a particular thing was changed, if there was a minority opinion, what the ramifications for the board would be in terms of implementation, et cetera, before just passing it. You know, otherwise I feel like I just kind of sent it somewhere who sent it back to me in a nicer package.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just address the issue of requiring a written report and that only. When we were discussing bylaws, I was chair of the bylaws committee for the IPNB. In that capacity, I was one of the people who contacted and communicated with Lenny Ganier, who gave us useful information, and she wouldn't have done it in requested. This would have run into tens of thousands of dollars, maybe. And she gave us useful information in writing, in an informal way. And I'm pretty sure she would have declined if the request was that she give us pro bono work.
Maria and William. William?
I don't have a problem with Patty's amendment, but I probably wouldn't vote for it because I just think that... Hear me out. I mean, it's the same reason why I have to step down from the secretary position. Let's just be real. We're sitting here and we're discussing a lot of motions that aren't in writing. And it's making it really confusing to do the work of the foundation. So I don't understand why that motion even needs to be passed, because anything that comes out of this committee is going to need to be written down. It doesn't mean that a lawyer has to commit to pro bono work. What it means is that there just needs to be someone who's willing to take the notes on the call while it's happening and get something out in a timely fashion. And if that means it falls on the secretary, it falls on the secretary to do that. So if there's a secretary on this committee that can take notes, they can encapsulate what a lawyer's recommendations might be, and it's not asking for pro bono work. It's just asking for someone to be scrupulous about taking notes around the recommendations that might come up out of this committee.
Maria? Speaking
of William's comment, could we have the Heffley Amendment restated? I could write it down.
Patty?
Okay. Added to this... to the motion that was that there to be reinstated or to be added, further resolved that all legal opinions obtained by this committee shall be presented in full and in writing as part of the committee's report.
Thank you.
Maria,
your minutes, William.
I know we're
First, I want to speak to the main motion and say that I think we're desperate for this, actually. I think in order to move forward, we are desperate to get all the legal opinions in front of us so that we can make informed decisions about this. And I want to move forward on affirmative action. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, you know, as a legislative staffer, we are constantly on the phone with legislative counsel. And they can't write everything out all the time, but an oral opinion, if they give us an oral opinion, we still have to take it down pretty much verbatim and for it to count as an oral opinion. So I think if what Patty is saying is that whoever is speaking with the lawyer has to take down the notes verbatim, make sure that's what the oral opinion is, then I think that that's the best way to keep the notes accurate. So I'm okay with that, and I think it's important that the whole board get what the lawyer said. The third thing is, I bet you I could find us some really great civil rights lawyers who would do at least majorly discounted work, if not pro bono, so I'm not all that worried about it. You know, they come on our shows all the time. They get free publicity from us all the time. I think that we could get discounted work, if not pro bono. I just that's, and maybe I'm, you know, pie in the sky in it, but I'm thinking. It
didn't happen the last time.
Well, okay. Maybe we didn't ask the right ones.
Michael and Dave, and then we've got to vote. One way or the other.
It's been my experience that a lot of opinions that are rendered by lawyers not only involve contemporary research, but also in terms of what they already know and what we already know, but also additional research because of recent changes in the law. And I think that, on the basis of the people that I've interacted with in the past, in terms of pro bono representation, you know, it's going to involve, I think, from a practical standpoint, an opinion that is non-written. And in order to get a written opinion, you're going to have to pay money. And I would advise against the writing down verbatim approach because I think it's far more effective if you can get a lawyer to give you an opinion for there to be a conference call or a meeting so that people can thoroughly digest that and ask the type of exhaustive questions that should be asked at that time, you know, as opposed to somebody writing down verbatim who is not a lawyer, who does not, for example, understand certain subtle legal nuances that only a lawyer understands about a given area, in this case, affirmative action. So that's my opinion. I think certainly it should be in writing, but from a practical standpoint, that involves money and bucks, you know, and expenditures that are paid out for that purpose. And I just don't know a lot of lawyers that would be able to do it without being paid. And I think the real feat would probably even be able to get lawyers in these times to do it on a pro bono basis to give an oral analysis.
First, I'd like to apologize. I wasn't able to be on the entirety of the call. I wasn't present for all of the arguments, although I did come back in. But I take Mark's point, absolutely. And I think that, generally speaking, that's a better way to do. On governance, we've been talking about this idea, and I think there should always be majority and minority reports so that the composition of the committee doesn't become the determining factor in what the board gets to hear or decide. And I think, as a result, the committees could spend more of their time working to achieve a synthesis of different views rather than one side trying to get their version of something before the body. So take that. Just want to say that to start. On the other point, I think the issue that Mr. Warren just raised, these issues of nuances, difference of opinion, I think what the amendment is trying to deal with is the idea of who represents what got said to whom. And so the question is who was present to hear, if it is an oral opinion, that oral opinion, and in particular if there are divergences on the body, and we need to be able to consider those differences. So maybe some form of a substitute, and I'm not going to make it here, but maybe what we need to consider is that the panel would be made available to the board meeting in executive session, because I do understand that one of the reasons for reticence about writing the stuff down is if somebody gives an opinion that says, oh, no, you can't go here or you can't do that, all of a sudden it becomes a problem later, which is one reason I think people were hesitant to write things down as well. And I think that was a reason that got brought up on the part of the discussion I did here. So I think we could solve it if the idea was that we would meet ultimately in executive session and we would all hear the representation from the people with expertise and each of the differing viewpoints so that we could make a considered decision rather than, again, it being represented through some bottleneck that might or might not catch the nuances you described. So maybe we should turn down this amendment and come up with a superior amendment that gets both full disclosure to us but doesn't create any of these other problems.
LeVarn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand the point here, and I believe it to be that what we wanted was a written legal opinion, because just an example, on our LSB there was an issue, and one of the LSB members brought an opinion that they said was by an attorney who would not give the attorney's name. So that's something that we have experienced. So
to say that to have a written written legal opinion with the person signing their name, I would certainly support that. And in terms of openness, fairness, and transparency.
Okay. There is a motion on the floor, and that's the reason I'm trying to get to it.
Well, there's a. I have a point of order that it's 11:48, and public comment was supposed to start at 11:45. I move that since we're not done with business and we have a time-sensitive item, that it just goes back to committee. That's my motion.
Second.
No, point of order. Hold on. Mr. Chair, he had a point of order, not a motion.
Yeah.
William, I think there's...
There is a motion, Patty's motion, and... Let's vote. You want to read your thing again and read it very slowly?
I've got it.
Okay, let's hear it.
Mr. Chair, the motion is to amend by Heffley, seconded by Foddy, to add language to the proposed governance motion by Adelson that states the following. Further resolve that all legal opinions retained by this committee shall be retained in full and part of this committee's report to the resolution.
Read that
to
again?
Add the language, quote, further resolve that all legal opinions retained by this committee shall be retained in full and part of this committee's report to the resolution.
That's not what she said. No. And she said written.
Yeah.
Patty, would you read it, please?
I gave it. I handed it.
I'm now feeling great karma with William right now.
All right, William.
Yeah. God bless you. And I don't even go to church right now.
I just screwed up on one word. I apologize.
Did you?
Let me restate it. To add this, the statement. Further resolve that all legal opinions retained by this committee shall be retained in full and part of this committee's report.
No. That's not
what? Written.
Patty.
And in writing as part of this committee's report.
Wait.
Now do it again.
Give Patty her motion back.
Yeah.
Further resolve that all legal opinions obtained by this committee shall be presented in full and in writing as part of the committee's report.
Point of information. I didn't quite get. Does the attorney have to submit it in writing, or can the commission write it up?
No, the point is that attorney, if he's going to give an opinion that's going to guide this foundation in a legal fashion, and we're going to go by it, he should put his name to it. And so if anything goes wrong, we can actually cite the lawyer. We have to on this board when we get this opinion, know that the lawyer said
it. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm moved. This is an amendment to a motion.
I would say the lawyer should write it. It says the lawyer's
order.
Do you second that? I'm going to table this. Motions.
It has been.
Well, the amendment and then
it has been moved and seconded that this proposal be tabled.
After public comment.
What'd you say, Dave? I want to refer.
Okay. Refer to.
To governance, to go back and work on it more.
All right. It's been moved and seconded.
Governance needs to work on this more.
Refer it back to governance. All those in favor of referring it back, raise your hands for a count.
Massage that boy.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Keep your hands up so I can count them. How many? Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All those opposed to referring it back. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All right. Referral has been defeated. The motion itself. All those in favor of Patty's motion, raise your hand.
The amendment allows for
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All those opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. All right, it fails. Now let's go to the original motion. All those in favor of the original motion, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Opposed? 1, 2, 3. Where's the fourth one? Okay, 4. 11 to 4. Today's motion passes. The governance committee's written thing passes. And now, if you will get me my pad back with the list of names of those who want to...
Anybody more?
And if there's anyone else who wants to, thank you.
Mr. Chair, could we have a quick bathroom break?
Yes. We're gonna have a 5-minute nature break, and all those who have not, but want to sign up, please come and do so. Give that to that lady there. Make sure Jane is on there.